Okay, so welcome to another episode of What Are You Guys Talking About?
What are you guys talking about?
Oh, today I think
that's my sensual voice.
Sounds kind of like
a sensual intro. What are you guys talking about after dark?
Uh-huh. Sounds a bit like sexy Eeyore, mate, so, you know, I'm just...
Oh, mate. Oh,
Do you think he's a dominant or a submissive? I'm not quite sure. I don't know which one it would be. Like, is he like it puts a lotion in the basket kind of Eeyore? Or is he more
dumb.
Like, yeah,
total
I don't know.
Dumb.
I don't know. It's just, Oh, good old Eeyore. All right. Well, welcome, everybody, to another episode. We are moving along swiftly into... It is pretty much the end of September over here, and we are moving in October. Things moving swiftly. Still a lot of changes going on. You know, in the bigger world, Fright Fest, of course, has been canceled as a physical event. Has been moved on to, you know, the virtual thing that it was. Many are doing that, I think... Celluloid Screams, which is the Sheffield Horror Festival that goes on every year, also very good. Still doing a physical one. I know Soho Horror Festival, which is Mitch Bain, also really good guy and puts on a good program. I think his is going to be virtual now from the 7th to the 9th. He was going to try to get 10 like core people, or like 20 of his core people to attend the actual festival so someone would watch these things. So... But yeah, it's just all being changed. And I find out about this because, you know, Dandelions is getting the host of rejections right now, which you know how it is. It's always like, we really like you, man. I mean, you're so enthusiastic. But, and I'm just kind of laughing. Like, I did go through the throes of a last hurrah with Dandelions. So after it played at Fright Fest, I do have to be honest that I spent probably far too much money on submissions.
Really?
Yeah, it was my birthday. So I was like, you know what? You know, why not? And now looking back at it, I was like, it was one of those impulse purchases. Spending a couple $100, just to be honest. And then looking back and being like, yeah, I don't think it's going to get into any of those, to be honest. Just because, like I said, I love Dandelions, but it was, it was made on my cameras.
It was what it was.
It's a great film, and it was a great experience. But, you know, we're kind of just focused on the next one. So just give you guys an update on the podcast on that, because I haven't released it on the Producer's Journey yet, but we are working on a short rapidly right now. It's currently titled Dia de los Muertos, but I can't, honestly, today I decided how much I hated that name, so we're going to be changing it to something more suiting when I can figure out what name I want to give it. But it's good. It was done right off the back of Memories of Murder, and Ed and I are rapidly working on getting this thing up and ready to shoot, and then hopefully we'll be on the production schedule, or actually probably the next short that the that LVP comes out with, so... Just a little bit of an update there for everybody. As you know, you can catch us on SoundCloud. You can catch us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the works. We're also available on social media, so pretty much anywhere you have social media. I don't do Snapfish or Snapchat or whatever it is. I'm sorry. It's because I didn't have to date in this decade, so sorry. It's,
do you not TikTok?
No, I don't TikTok. I could. Like, I have it downloaded because I'm like, oh, I should start using this to get involved in social media, but... Again, it took me long enough to learn how to use Twitter, and even then nobody ever tweets me back. So, you know, like, sorry, but we get to the point at LVP where old man Jay's like, so when are we going to hire in that social media manager?
How many hours a day do you have
when are you going to get me that fresh young 18-20-year-old, you know, intern who wants to do all this for me? You know what I mean? And can actually... Yeah, that's all I mean. Like, don't get me wrong. We do the Facebook presence really well. I love our website. And I think we do a good job on social media, but we are not... Ed and I are in our late 30s, not our early 20s. And so, you know what I mean? We definitely are not people who are, I would say, on the influencers list and stuff like that. Something we hope to improve. But again, watch this space. And if you're interested in helping us on that, please, by all means, just drop us a line. So I have been talking to people about getting a social media manager for us. At any rate, so those are all the
Speaking
different ways.
Speaking of influencers.
Yes, okay.
Well, no, just the film that we're going to be discussing today.
Oh, yes, we are influencers with that, so yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, that's a really good kind of preface to at least what I'd like to say about the film. So we are going to review today Netflix number one, well, it's number two in the UK, I believe, but big smash hit, Enola Holmes, starring the glorious Millie Bobby Brown and Henry Cavill as Sherlock Holmes. A wonderful film, and I have a lot to say about it because it was wonderful, but it wasn't that wonderful to me. And I think that's the reason it fits perfectly on Netflix. But those are my first impressions. If you like Millie Bobby Brown. If you like lighthearted, you know, adventures, then this is the show for you to watch with your kids. You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't suggest against really little kids, but I would say if you have young adults or teenagers or whatever, this is a great one to sit and watch with. So, Ed, first impressions from you on Enola Holmes.
I'm gonna be quite bold here.
Go ahead, please.
And I'm gonna say that this had the fun and the adventure of classics like Indiana Jones, and I wouldn't compare it, you know, filmically, if that is in fact a word, to you know, Indiana Jones. But I don't know. It had that kind of fun feeling that perhaps, you know, the Goonies or films that we kind of grew up with, you know, with like child protagonists. It had a lot of that kind of just fun vibe to it.
Yes.
So I enjoyed it immensely. And I think Millie Bobby Brown is, she's awesome. I think she's going to be a fantastic movie star. I'm still on the fence about whether she's going to be a stellar actress or not. We kind of talked about this the other day when we were talking on the phone, and I completely agreed with you when you said that you thought that she was going to have to prove herself, like whether it's through taking, you know, challenging roles or working with, you know, the right kind of directors and stuff. Yeah, she's going to have to kind of trial by fire a little bit.
Yeah, it's just, you know, when we were talking about this yesterday, Ed, like, it's again, the beauty of all the stuff that you've been showing me kind of in the last, let's say, 2 or 3 months, as far as the way that things are shot and kind of how the business works and, you know, some of the more in-depth stuff that I didn't know before. You know, the issue of celebrity is one of those things that it's a very interesting part of the business to me, because at first I used to think it was ridiculous, and now it's so essential to the psychology of a film. So, right. I mean, think Enola Holmes. You really can't think outside of this film but for Millie Bobby Brown, right?
Yeah.
And that's both a blessing and a curse. Like, okay. It just depends. So if Millie Bobby Brown ends up being an actress that can attract, you know, all sorts of people watching her films no matter what she does, then she'll be okay for her career. Or if she hones her skills as an actress and becomes one of those must have because a director needs her for the performance. So you go either one of two ways. Either you become, you know, a model actress, or you become, you know, something that the fans love. I think it's better to become the model actress and the one the director likes, because I think then you can at least give up, or don't have to give up so much of yourself. But, you know, other actresses just choose to live in the public eye their entire life. But that's I guess that's my point, is like, that's why it breaks children usually, because the idea of your life being under scrutiny and being part of the public discussion from the age of whatever can be devastating, I think, when you're growing up. I mean, I don't know. It's not like you or I really have that experience. But as far as a business case for Millie Bobby Brown, at the moment, like, that's why Enola Holmes got made. She produced this. It's a
vehicle for
her. So, I mean, to give you a bit of background as to this film and to why my views are mixed on the film itself. I liked it, and I agree with Ed, but it troubles me a little bit that this is the venue it's going to be on. And I'm going to explain why kind of throughout this podcast. But basically, these types of films will be on Netflix and nowhere else, I would say, for a while. While that's good for the studios because it lets them stick around and lets them keep making some money, my issue is that this film is infinitely more fun in the theater. And so it kind of bums me out just a little bit.
Gotcha.
Where, I mean, obviously we were talking about Bill and Ted as well, and that was another one that kind of bummed me out for the same reason, because I was like, this is a film that I didn't need to see in that theater, and I kind of just saw it at home. And this one, because you have, like you said, the quick animation sequences on the train, I don't know why I like seeing that in the theater more, but I do. I like train, like the chases and stuff like that, I always like them better when I'm like sat in my favorite G7, that's my seat, G7 in the movie theater. And, you know, and watching it on the big screen. And, you know, not it didn't have to be an IMAX, but I just that better. So,
interesting.
So, I mean, getting into some of the brass tacks about this film and some of the background, again, it's Legendary Pictures have made this film. And it's interesting because Legendary Pictures, other films that you may have heard of are Pokemon Detective Pikachu.
Okay.
which was a $150 million big budget film that blew away the box offices a while ago. They're behind Dune, so the company that's doing Dune. Mm-hmm. And their other big release is Godzilla v. King Kong, which is, especially if you're Stevie Reeves, I don't know if Stevie, if you ever listened to this, but Stevie Reeves is like the biggest Godzilla fan I've ever met. So I think he's raving about that one. But the point is they're a big budget studio. And actually, in my view, this comes onto Netflix because of what's going on right now, because of COVID, not because of any other reason. I think this was always slated to be a big budget film release and then had to be kind of shoehorned into Netflix at the last minute. So, but it is a great mid-market studio film, I would say, for families. I would say one of those things, and maybe you can comment on that, Ed, I did find the audience selection questionable. Like, are you pitching this to me as a young adult film? Are you pitching this to me as a family film? Are you pitching this to me as a murder mystery film? It seemed a little bit of all three. So we have, and it also is pitched as kind of a women's rights film, which, you know, that does feed into the zeitgeist of what's going on. Those types of films tend to be very popular right now. So I got that part. I said, and no one is really better at doing that, I think, in modern parlance than Helena Bonham Carter. She has become kind of, I think, you know, she's almost like a Frida Kahlo now. You know what I mean? She did.
Yeah, like she looks surprisingly like her, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, she just has that. You know, Frida Kahlo is one of my favorite, you know, females in history, just because she was a kind of woman that never cared whether people looked at her, the way people looked at her, at least that way. You know what I mean? It was like, woman, no woman, I'm an artist, you know? And Helena Bonham Carter, it's just because I've followed her career now, I feel like, for a while, like, just always, I think, does embody that woman without compromise. You know what I mean? That just needs to be part of this film. But I guess that's my feel, and I don't know how you feel about that. I don't know who they were actually pitching this at. It's number two in the UK, so maybe all of them, you know? I don't know.
Yeah. I think you're probably right. I think all of them. I think that, you know, the young adult market has been kind of lackluster in recent times with the Divergent series and, you know, basically since, you know, the Hunger Games and Twilight kind of ended their runs. There really hasn't been a lot in that category that seems to have connected.
No, only thing I can think of, we were watching it last Sunday. As I said, because I got the Blu-rays for my birthday, we watched His Dark Materials. So that...
ooh, nice.
Yeah, the first episode again. And it was fun, Eddie. I went back and listened to our first podcast. I do say it was like our first date, because it did feel that way when I was listening to it. I was like, oh, he was so young and little. But
awkward.
It was, but that was a good moment.
But no, I think you're right. I think it did try and hit a lot of buttons, and that's always a risk. I think it's often better to, you know, like you say, know your audience, know exactly who you're trying to target.
Yeah, it's just, listen, my concern on that is this, and sorry to rant a bit further on it, but it's because I delved, like, as I was thinking about this, you know, I delved into it further, like. So the way the pricing model works for Netflix for a film like this, and how does it differ from the box office? Well, with Netflix, everything is paid up front for this film. So in other words, if you took $150 million to make, you go to Netflix with your film, they'll sit down and they'll say, okay, all considered, everything on the table, we'll give you $250 for the film. And you say, okay, well, it cost me $150 to make. It cost me... $250, you know, it's going to make me $250, so we have $100 million on the books. Now, the next question comes is, well, how did Netflix figure out what that $250 was supposed to be? Well, that's based on their viewing metrics, and it's a closely guarded secret at Netflix.
Yeah, but that's the interesting thing, isn't it?
But you're pricing a film based on who they think on their streaming platform is going to, you know, subscribe to this. Or is it going to keep people watching? Is it content that people want? And, you know, they're very clear about how they do it. They just don't, obviously, like an insurance company, they're not going to tell you the backgrounds to those metrics. They don't tell you, you know, who's getting weighted where and how much is being put here or there. You kind of just have to take it on at least some face value that when they say, you know, I don't know how much was paid for this, but, you know, we give you $250, that's the best you can get. So what's the alternative? Why is that possibly a bad thing? Well, the alternative is the box office. And the box office, a lot of people would tell you about first week domestic gross or gross box office, but the real money that people look to recover, at least traditional investors, when it comes to film, comes in the long term. You're talking about your residuals and where you're going to license this out, and you know the fact
DVD
that you're going to get
sales,
exactly, you're going to get 10 years worth of payment on this. That's going to make up for your box office sales are important, but you're also going to tail on that. And in this way, at least in the articles and the research I was doing, they were pointing out that this is a problem, like because you could be in a position where you could have made a lot more money on the film than you did it
in the long term. Yeah.
Yes. Equally, it's also a really safe bet for a film like this. So, you know, in case I don't get a chance to summarize what I'm talking about here, listen, Enola Holmes is a film that was destined for a big budget, but was never going to come out because of COVID. If you haven't seen the pushback of dates on everything right now, you know, you just turn on Variety or Hollywood Reporter and you'll see everything's being pushed back to next year. So part of that's because of all the things that go into showing at the box office, you know. Star power, like, you know, Millie Bobby Brown can't do any appearances. She can't go on, you know, TV and talk about this film to people or go to the red carpet premiere. Like, that's a big deal. All of this generates more money for the film. Yeah. And so that's the interesting thing. So what had to happen is Legendary Pictures was sitting on this, what they thought was a big budget film. But, you know, as I said, the budget hasn't been released. But, I, you know, I, what would you say would be budget on this, Ed? I mean, are we talking as big as $150 million, do you think?
No, I would, I think 100 would probably do it. I reckon.
That's what I thought. In my head, I was pitching it at like 70 or 80, and that was only because it's a period piece. So you have to have all of that, you know, all your prop work just has to have all that extra money put into it. So it looks right. Yeah. So 70, 80 million you're going to make. Let's say they offered 150 million for it. Then you make what you put into it. You make double what you had. At least then you've got the money and you don't
it's
have
money
to
in your hand. Yeah.
And basically the difference is, you know, for Millie Bobby Brown, she's reliant now on the metrics from Netflix saying, we like you. So please come and let us make a film for you again. For Millie Bobby Brown, being Stranger Things being her thing, I don't think that's even remotely a problem. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just not something I think she has to consider that way.
It's funny, because I was reading an article recently which was talking about the points. I think it's actually that video that I sent you on creative accounting, the Hollywood creative accounting thing.
Okay.
And it was the development of the idea of selling points on a film to potential stars, because that way they could kind of do some creative accounting and not pay any residuals to people. Like, every film loses money, you know. And it's very interesting, because this is a similar situation where it's like, do you take the money up front that Netflix is offering you, or do you gamble on that, you know, long-term revenue stream?
Okay. And this is cool, because we're actually progressing. I have a bunch of notes here on this that I didn't think we'd get to till later, but here's the problem I have with that model too. So I went through, you know, Netflix is not a company that's having any sorts of problems right now. So when I, you know, first thing I looked at was how do they come up with the, you know, the money, how do they come up with the figure that they want to use? And their exact statements is, it says, Netflix uses consumer data mining to determine which content viewers pay to see and relies heavily on this information to determine the total cost for each licensing agreement. The data is compiled to determine the expected hours of viewing each TV show or movie generates over the course of a licensing agreement, establishing cost per hour viewed. So everything, and again, it's all breaks down to simplicity, and I think that's where the problem is going to lie, down to a cost per hour per viewer.
Right.
So for them. Now, what do the numbers mean? Well, when you look at how they're doing, the 2019, they're doing well as a business. The 2019 contributions to profit for domestic streaming, international streaming, and domestic DVD respectively were $3.3 billion, $1.6 billion, and $174 million. Domestic streaming comprised two-thirds of profits, even though it accounted for less than half. Now, again, I'm racing ahead here just to stop and say, here's my problem, okay? Those profits are entirely driven, and we're talking 100% driven 100% driven by subscription services. They have no other, as far as I know, and I went through their books to try to figure this out, because obviously it's a publicly listed company. So the only three real ways that they have to generate money are A, their profits through new subscribers, B, through a what we call a corporate bond, which would be a loan that says, you know, Mr., you pay me $200,000 now and I'll pay you back later at a percentage point. So let's say like 10% or something like that. And then the other way they can, because they're a publicly listed company, is to raise shares for themselves. So they can raise capital that way. Here's the issue. Because their profits are so transparent, okay? Mm-hmm. You can literally look at their balance sheet and their profit sheet and know this has to do with how many subscribers they have, what they're charging per subscriber. The only additional way for them to make money is to increase the subscription fee. And that is going to reach a critical mass at some point. So right.
That was
going
to be my question. So do you think that, yeah, does this all have a ceiling then? Is there like a limit?
Yes. And I think that's my concern with the model, is saying it's good for now. It's perfect for COVID. Like, it's absolutely 100% perfect for COVID. However, there is going to come a point, and this is just more of a Netflix problem than it is a problem for streaming, but there is going to come a problem where, because Netflix does not generate its money any other way, it's going to have to do something to change all of this. And that will usually mean either adding some advertising or doing something that fills its consumer base. And right, and what right, I worry right. about that is then you start shifting film like this into more of a TV type of thing, where you're trying to appease a more mass market. So
right.
it's a stretch, I know. It's just I was running through all the figures, and I thought, well, for now, the Netflix model is the perfect COVID model, because you pay up front for a movie, so you could, you know how much money you're going to make from a film. It goes out. You don't have to worry about the endless promotion of it, because, you know, it's going to be on a streaming service. So it gets promoted when it first comes out, and then, you know, it's done. Like, you have no more responsibility to keep the film going. Actors and actresses are still getting visibility like they needed before. But my fear is, you know, it's because I watched all that history of film stuff that shows that this all influences stuff down the line. And I'm like, but I don't want film to go that route, if that makes sense.
In fact, I think that we've already seen some examples of that. You know, we've been talking a little bit about, you know, your deep dive into Marvel and stuff like that. And we were talking about Iron Fist not that long ago.
Yes.
And I believe I read somewhere that the reason it was 13 episodes was specifically because Netflix wanted 13 episodes. I think that the writers originally wanted to do 10. And that's true for a lot of the Marvel Netflix stuff. And it's funny because it all does feel a little bit long.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, catching you up where I am with MCU and all stuff like that. So, I mean, I told it. I watched Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 for the first time, and, man, like, felt like I missed out on that one. But Ed, it was followed up by the best one. I forgot why it is, like, still my favorite Marvel film. Spider-Man, you are the man.
Yeah.
I just, like, it just reminds me of when I was a kid. Like, Spider-Man was always my favorite comic book when I was younger. And, like, Spidey's just a New Yorker, man. So, like, totally just love that film. And Marissa Tomei's Aunt May is just a great addition, you know? Like, Marissa Tomei screams New York. So, like, yeah, I was very pleased with it. But contrast what I thought was maybe one of the greatest films in the MCU, even though it was made by Sony. That's interesting. Like, it's a film made with Amy Pascal, who's been on the Spider-Man franchise for most of her production career. Moved over to work with Kevin Feige to get this done. But, man, they knock it out of the park. Like, it's such a good film and so different from everything else that MCU does that I was like, I can just see why it's one of the prized franchises of Marvel.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
You know, it really just, you know, I watched it twice. I remember I watched it, the first time and being like, wow, I forgot how much I love this film. And then I watched it again just to watch they had, like, Spidey trivia. And it was really sad because in the whole thing, there were actually only, like, 7 trivia cards, but I watched the whole thing all over again just to catch those 7 trivia cards. So what's my point about all this? Well, then I went on to the Defenders, which I would say from the initial part, like from the opening, it looked like, okay, finally, they're putting enough money into this so that the Netflix stuff can be as good as the movies, because it has, you know, Luke Cage, I really enjoyed for what it was. But like you said, it was too long. Jessica Jones, like, it was okay. It just...
It dragged a little at the end.
Oh, it drags the whole way through. And yeah. And so the Defenders, I finally thought, well, if they have to put them all on an action-paced... what, you know, if they all have to go on an adventure together, they have to do this quick. Couldn't be further from the truth. I'm on episode 3 of the Defenders, and it's like watching five... It's like watching all four of those things at the same time. It's really... Yeah. Really annoying.
It's like molasses.
Yeah. Oh my god! Like you'd think, like it's just, and I don't know where that comes from, but it's the problem with the entirety of the MCU on Netflix is the pacing, and some of it's really, really good. Like some of it, like I love the Daredevil stuff. I'm not always keen on the Elektra storyline. I really think sometimes they haven't provided the depth in that storyline to make it worthwhile. But fair enough. You know, the Jessica Jones, but I like Jessica Jones for what it is. Like, I don't, if I'm being honest, I don't really like the narrative and I don't really like the character, but I really appreciate the type of character it is. Like, there's nothing quite like Jessica Jones on TV, and that's a shame, because that's a type of superhero. That's a, not even a type of superhero, it's a type of anti-hero that exists in the world and should have shows made about it, because, you know, I just think it's rallying against that bitch profile. You know, one of the worst things I think exists in this world is that women with an opinion are automatically labeled as a bitch. And maybe it's because I grew up with some very opinionated women, but you know what I mean? Like that's how it is, man. Like, you know what I mean? You shouldn't expect a woman to be anything. You should just accept her for who she is.
Speaking of, I liked the feminist angle on Enola Holmes. I was worried that it was going to be too heavy handed. But I thought that they did a good job. And again, I think a lot of that is casting Helena Bonham Carter, which I had an argument with my mother over, because she doesn't get her as an actress. She doesn't believe her. And I was like, well, you're crazy, girl.
That is entirely, I'm not sure. I don't know how traditional my wife really is. And I probably like I said, we let her on the podcast to say that, but I think for like a traditional English woman, she can be really affronting, you know, like, you know, her whole relationship with Tim Burton. Tim Burton leaves his wife basically for her, which, you know, it's Hollywood. So that's, we love to read about it, guys. So, you know, don't boohoo it because
celebrity.
Exactly. That's what they're paid to be. But she lives in a house she's not married to him anymore, because they couldn't stand being married to one another. And she lives in a house like next to him. You know what I mean? And she makes no bones about that. And she makes no bones about anything.
That is super Frida Kahlo, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just, it's the type of woman she is, and the type of woman that they're talking about. You know, and this is, just hold the phone before we say too much. Like, we are talking about women, two dudes on a podcast. So, before people come over the parapet and start throwing things at us, like, listen, man, like, I'm not trying to say nothing about no women, okay? I'm just trying to describe the film. Y'all can be whoever you want to be, and I love women, all right?
Like, and in fact, the name of this is from a women's perspective, isn't it? The name of the show, so...
Yeah.
What are you guys talking about?
Well, yeah, it's my mom. Moi. It's moi, the first strong woman in my life. So that's what I mean. The whole thing is geared, isn't it, towards, like, this... You know, and I do this, too. So one of my favorite... You know, Catherine gets this for me all the time, and she'll roll her eyes at first, and then, listen, her mother bought her this book of, like... famous women in history, because sadly it's true. I never realized until I had a daughter, but there are so many women in history that no one knows nothing, you know, anything about. So this is a book full of that. And so when she asked me to read her story now, I know it sounds very cliche, but that's what I do. I open the book and I say, who are we going to read about today? And we pick a new person to learn about. And
strong women, you know, that's
well, you know, I mean, about. you know, Catherine already, and you know, my wife, I mean, I have strong women in my life already, but I want her to be able to use that to her advantage. And that's why I thought, and this is where I was kind of laughing. I thought the two of them would love this film. If I'm honest, they watched about half of it and they were like, meh.
Really? That's crazy.
Well, and I think it's because, and this is no affront whatsoever to Helena Bonham Carter or Millie Bobby Brown, but at times, it is style over substance. And I think you're going to get that because it's Netflix. Like, you know, yes, it's about women's rights and the way women should be different, but really, Ed, did it do anything to talk about it in Victorian times? Like, there's no actual serious piece there. And it's all fantasy. So...
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I guess I was surprised neither one. Maybe they retired because it was like, I was like, but you guys love murder mysteries and this is all about strong women. And
I would have guessed that they would have loved it as well.
No, Catherine was falling asleep.
Maybe it's aimed at like middle-aged dudes.
I have no idea. That's what started me scratching my head a bit. I was like, they don't want to watch this. Like, aren't they the key audience that was supposed to watch this? So
that's where
I started getting a bit confused because I was like, well, they should be being like, I love this. Then again, as I said, it's number two in the UK and number one in the US next to Ratchet. So, you know what I mean? Like, it's not like it's doing badly. Everybody is watching it.
Did you feel that the mystery had enough kind of meat to it?
No. I mean, this is what I mean about the film itself. Like, Ed, like, man, it was so throwaway. Like, I just wasn't interested. I was like, I like Millie Bobby Brown, and I liked her character enough to pay attention to when she spoke, and I like the use of the fourth wall breaking. I thought that was that's what
I
makes
like that as well.
I thought it was what made it a bit more kid-like or very Ferris Bueller, right? That's what I can remember him doing that a lot. In that, I think she held up really well for it and set it up. Like, they were talking about sequels, and I was like, yes, this definitely set up a franchise, you know. Mm-hmm. But as far as being a film for the cinema, like, at times I felt like this was like an after school special.
Okay, yeah, like almost like an episode of a TV show.
Yeah, like, well, like, I, you know, I bought for all her help during Fright Fest and all the other stuff, I bought my wife the Poirot collection. She loves Poirot, and Poirot looks just like my dad, so we love to watch Poirot and laugh that he looks like Tony Shiroe. But it reminded me of like an extended episode of Poirot.
Yes, and this brings me to my central question that I wanted to ask you.
Sure.
I felt, and a couple of people actually asked me how many episodes that there were of this, but I felt that this might actually have been better suited as a serialized show.
Absolutely, 100%. When I put it on, I thought I was putting on... When you suggested, I think I remember saying that to you. You were like, let's
you
do
it.
I'm like,
I'm
not doing another TV series just because, unfortunately, that means we have to do like seven shows on it. And His Dark Materials would do, but right now I didn't want to dedicate seven shows to a series. So I was like, no, we're not going to do that. You know, it's a movie. And exactly as you said, Ed, I was like, why wasn't this just made into a film? It's because of how it worked. So you have to understand, like, that's why I was interested in picking this apart, Ed, because I bet you it would have been. It's just what really ended up happening. So the true Hollywood story, you know, was
behind
that Legend,
the scenes.
Legendary Pictures made a good film. Like, they had a good idea with this. And I think with the right promotion, like, it would have been absolutely fine in the theaters. I think people would have really, I think it would have had, I guess this is my point, Ed, like, TV show, sure, as another vehicle for Millie Bobby Brown. You know what I mean? Mm. I think this is her way of showing just how fun she can be on the other end of the camera and how talented she is at kind of pushing boundaries. You know, she produces this. So this is her project. This is something she put together. And on that note, I mean, Millie, you did a great job. Like, Jesus Christ, if you want to produce something with me, like, you have hella talent. Like, you definitely hit on the things that make you popular and make you famous and things like that. What I think was missed is because this never went in the box office, all that women's rights stuff, I think, just comes across as an after TV special where it could have had much more impact in the cinema. I just think you could have elevated it more and it would have had more, I don't know, not seriousness, just more, you know, look what happened with Little Women, which, you know, is still one of my favorite stories because Greta Gerwig, most people don't, you know, I don't know if most people know this or not, but she is the female lead. And I've mentioned this before on the podcast to one of my favorite stupid comedies, which is Arthur. Mm. And the fact that she made Little Women's a great film, if you haven't seen it, by the way, it's a modernization of, you know, the old tale. But that one really talked about modern female empowerment and what that looks like and how that differs from what we thought about female empowerment in the Pride and Prejudice days, as I would say. This doesn't really do any of that, you know what I mean? And I don't think it could have, you know, I think it would have had an easier time of talking about those issues had it been put in the theaters as opposed to just something that's going to be number one on Netflix for a while and then move on.
Okay, but let me get to my actual question.
Oh, dear. Oh, shit. Sorry, Ed.
So, you know, you've kind of, like, lit a match when it comes to, like, writing and stuff like that. I'm super impressed by it. In an ideal world, as a storyteller, what would be your kind of perfect medium? Do you feel like the TV miniseries model, or like the multiple season, you know, 24 episode, TV show, the movie, the trilogy, is, do you feel like there's a, you know,
this is where I really start thinking things get interesting as I develop, and as we develop as a film production company, and as I develop as someone who works in film and TV. And I think it's whatever you want it to be, and it's like, what kind of story do you want to tell? So you can do a series, a non-limited series, so season one, season two, season three. What's different about that? Well, with that, you have to create characters. I think this fits that. If you can use Enola as the lead, Henry Cavill as a strong Sherlock, and maybe two or three players, maybe like the jujitsu instructor and someone else, like...
Crazy that we saw The Nightingale and Sam Claflin was in that, and then he shows up in this, like, as Mycroft.
Oh, God, like, yeah. Oh, my God. He's great, man. I didn't make the connection. Is that... Who does he play in The Nightingale? Is that the lead guy?
Yeah, the bad guy.
Oh, my God. No wonder. Yeah. I really hated him right off the bat, and that probably explains it.
He's great.
You're a dirty bastard. You're...
Yeah. He's great. And the lady who plays
the Tewksbury grandmother?
Who I absolutely love as well. But the lady who...
jiu-jitsu instructor.
Not jiu-jitsu instructor.
Just running through the cast now.
The headmistress. Of the school.
Harry Potter lady herself.
Yes. She is fantastic.
That's the other things to kind of get out about this. Again, we're dissecting because we can dissect, guys. Again, remember, this is my film school, so that's the whole point, is to make arguments and to see where we get with them. But there's a lot of positives behind this. Okay, this was an English production, guys. Like, this was made right around town. You know, I think a lot of it shot in Bedford. Sussex. Do you know what I mean? So, and most of the cast is English. So it was one thing that I was happy when I read the production notes to see, here we go. Like, a completely English production and cast. I'm always saying that. I think you guys miss a trick here in giving so much business to the Americans. No offense to myself, I guess. You know what I mean? But there's so much talent here in England right now for making film. It's just nice to see productions like this that are just using the talent at home, at base. Albeit most of these people are big stars now, but if you look at the cast list, it's all English based. These are, even Millie Bobby Brown. I always forget she's English.
She's also like, she's kind of like me a little bit. She grew up in Spain.
Mm.
And so she speaks like amazing Spanish. Mm. I'd love to see her play like a Spanish role. I think that'd be really
cool. It's interesting because, I mean, she produced this. So these questions we're asking, I mean, it'd be funny. I'm not sure we could ever get her on the show, but it'd be something to ask her because I'm sure that was something that was put up. It was like, do you want to fund this as a series? Do you want to fund this as a movie? Do you want to fund this as that? And I think at the moment, it's Legendary Pictures because it's Legendary Pictures. So remember, they're a franchise builder, big film builder. They see this as, let's release multiple Enola Holmes over time. And I think it's possible. Now, here's the trick. If this came out in the theater, would you go see it? Like, if Enola Holmes 2 comes to the box office next year in 2021, when we're all, fingers crossed, back out and alive and doing these things again, are you going to go? And that's what I'm saying. I'm like, I'm not sure. I'm like, I'll go because I have my film pass, but it won't be my first choice.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. I guess I don't consider myself the target audience, but maybe I am. So who knows?
You never get to know how it played out. And it will be one of those questions for me, And exactly answering, further answering your question. For me, like, the best format for this, I think, based on the story that I watched, Ed, so not thinking what could be, not thinking, what might have been, thinking about what was put on the screen, it should have been a limited series, like 7 episodes. Same as they're doing with the Defenders.
Exactly. Yeah.
I still think those are the most effective ones on Netflix. I think Those limited
it's
series.
It's bingeable. It's like keeps people on the site, which is what they want.
Yep.
No, I agree. And they could have done like, because it's a book series, right? It's based on a book series.
Yes, it's so. Six books were made about this. I don't know if I got the author down, but no, six young adult books.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what I mean. Like, a limited series to me would have just covered what it needed to cover. And the problem with TV shows these days, obviously, is the continuity. Like, when you set up season one of a TV show, you have to always be thinking about season two and season three and season four. And it's like, so you do the tropes, the TV tropes. And I only know this, obviously, because I'm watching a ton of TV right now for MCU. And, like, you see that. They have to do certain things. So I just finished... You know, this is all the stuff I've been getting through. I've just finished season four of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is what I call, like, the Matrix season.
Yes.
Because, like, it's great the one... It is. It really is. Like, but they do it in the most Buffy... I mean, that was Joss Whedon all over the place. You know what I mean? That was... Because first it starts being about robots, and then it's not about robots. It's about the AI that they use. I mean, it just went everywhere. Absolutely everywhere.
Wait until you get to next season, though.
Yeah, no, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. And it's what you should be doing with a TV show. Why do you do that with a TV show? Well, it's so you keep interest up. The problem is, if they don't do those types of things, if they don't make it comic booky where it's changing all the time, then you just get bored and series fizzle out. And even though the funniest thing is it may not feel like a TV show is going to fizzle out. You may be quite happy with the content, but those viewership ratings just slowly start to drop over time.
Right.
And that's the killer for them, because that's how they get their advertising. So,
and especially like in the age of the streaming platform and you know, how that has risen since Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. really kind of came out.
But yeah.
I thought it improved a lot as the years went by. I was really, really impressed with it.
Yeah, I think, and that's the flip side to the looking at Enola Holmes. So do we think the current version that we saw today, the 2-hour version of that movie, could be bettered? That's what you get when you don't make a limited series, and instead you say, let's do a season. You get improvement and kind of growth. Right. And so is that available here? Like, I don't know. I honestly don't know, because you only have such a small cast of characters. So limited series would be the way to go. Movies, fine. I just, like I said, you miss all the big, a lot of the big box office stuff would have been fun. Like the train chase would have been much more fun on a big screen than it was at home. True. So, you know, that's what I think you're missing on that. But again, like the end thing to catch with all this, and I'll put the links to the articles and the description, but check to see how this works as a business model. It's a really good way to understand the difference in selling a film to Netflix versus the box office. This was a safe bet for Legendary Pictures, again, because they just went straight. It was all decided before the movie was even released. That is very different from how you work at a box office, where you're looking at how much money you're going to make over a 5 to 10 year period with residuals and everything like that. Wow. That's generally how you'll sell to investors. If you have, you know, if you like the idea of just having a lump sum that's going to be paid for your productions, then you need to get on the platform for Netflix, because for now, that's how they're buying. And I say for now because that's not going to last forever. That can't last forever. At some point, they're going to have as many subscribers as they're ever going to have. They're going to have charged as much money as what people are willing to pay for it. And they're going to have to figure out other revenue streams.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So... cool. All right. Well, you know, let's look at some other aspects of it. What about, you know, Mr. Cameraman? What were some of the things you liked about that? One thing I noticed about this film is that it, you know, it's under the New English style. And I call it New English style because it all seems to me a little bit like Guy Ritchie. It had some very fast cuts into it.
Mm.
But what was your feel on the cinematography? I don't know who L is.
11. 11 from
there
Stranger
you go.
Things.
So,
the director is Harry Bradbeer, who is actually perhaps more famous for working on TV.
That's what I mean.
He did some work on Fleabag and also on Killing Eve.
Correct.
Yeah, and you know, I think it shows. He's clearly very used to the kind of prestige TV that that has to look good, you know? Like, it's not like in the old days when you said our TV and you thought, okay, it just doesn't look great, or it looks cheap, or whatever.
Yeah, establishing shot, behind the camera, you know,
like
shot.
Super overlit, you know.
Exactly, camera right over the shoulder, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
but,
so
yeah,
it
no
worked,
perspective.
It worked well, I think, but I think you're absolutely right. A lot of this stuff would have just been better on a big screen. Particularly, that train kind of cat and mouse little game that they do, which is such a nice traditional kind of film thing.
Mm.
And I thought it was done really well. And I thought that it was charming while still being action packed and well directed. So. At no point did I think, oh, this looks shit. But at the same time, at no point was I wowed by, the frame or the lighting or anything in particular.
No, I like that you brought up that, I mean, because I remember looking up the director and noticing his credits and noticing that he was completely TV. Because again, like, and maybe this just all fits now. But that's kind of another thing that sits in the back of my head is like, this was going to go on the big screen. I wonder whether this would have looked like a TV show put on the big screen.
On the big screen, interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to think of the magnitude of the shot. So a lot of that comes from folks is, you know, would a wide angle shot, is it going to look the same blown up as it is there? Because he doesn't have too many of those. But I mean, you have the big shots at the end. I really like that kind of ending where the two brothers are kind of talking about her and she's sitting in the corner kind of listening to what they're saying about her future. I really quite enjoyed that. But that had some very open and wide shots.
Yeah. You're right. There was, particularly when she was like working things out, there was that very kind of Guy Ritchie-esque fast cutting.
Yeah.
You know.
And that's what I mean. It would have looked... So the biggest thing I can remember where you'd see something like that, the last time we had a fourth, and it's interesting, there seems to be a trend at the moment, and catch me if I'm wrong on this, but a lot of fourth wall movies are female movies at the moment. So the last one I can remember seeing was Birds of Prey, which was good. I think, I can't remember if we did a podcast on Birds of Prey or not.
We didn't, because I haven't seen it.
Yeah, so that's what, you know, with Harley Quinn, that has, you know, obviously that's Harley Quinn telling you she always loves to narrate, so she turns to the screen quite a bit to tell you what's going on, and you have, she'll draw things like, you know, like a teleprompter, you know, like a thing on the screen for you. So I think it would have looked more like that, and I wonder if it would have just naturally transitioned a bit better onto the screen. I don't know. I can't really... Oh, it's one of those things now I kind of want to see it on the big screen.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
But think about that for a business idea, guys. When COVID ends, who wants to open like a movie theater where you can just watch Netflix film on the big screen? You know what I mean? Like...
Not a bad idea, man.
It's just the truth, right? I'm sure we could get the DCPs. You know what I mean? Like, wouldn't be a problem. So yeah, I mean, cinematography-wise, it did look adequate, like you said, but nothing that, like, you know, we're a bit, you know, and I can't believe you've converted me this way. For the years,
I love it.
Next time we meet up with Chris Burton, right? He's your other little camera buddy, I remember. And then Sash, good old Sash. But, like... Yeah,
You into a baguette smoking, beret wearing.
Man, a great shot is a great shot, though. You know what I mean? And like, that's my problem. Is like, if I'm being honest, I worked through most of this film because that's how interested I was in it. Because nothing was striking me too hard, so it wasn't a bad film by any
means. That's the danger with Netflix films as well. That's the thing. You can very easily start to multitask, and you know, I was just watching Zodiac, which, by the way, good film. Specifically, there's a scene.
It's a Jake Gyllenhaal film, Ed. You know how I feel.
I know. But there's one scene that I need you to watch because I think it would look good in Dia de los Muertos.
You're gonna force me to watch a Jake Gyllenhaal film. That's so mean.
it's also a David Fincher film. So
I know, no, I need to watch it. I need to watch it. That was a film. It was interesting. We could do a podcast on it because that one was supposed to do so much better in the cinemas when it came out, Ed, and it didn't. Like, for some reason, it didn't have, you know, it was Fincher's, it was just like Seven, you know, it was another really good, you know, kind of mystery. And I just remember it coming out and it flopping. And I, you know, it wasn't because it was bad. It was just didn't, I think it had a lot of competition at the time. It's almost having like a second renaissance now, on Netflix because people are catching this film. And I'm just kidding, Jake Gyllenhaal. You're an amazing actor, by the way. I just it's an ongoing joke in our family. But
a lot of people think it's Fincher's best film. I don't know if I would go that far, but
it's the kind of thing that's what I mean. Like, and I remember it coming out and it bombing. Because I'd read. You know, this is a funny thing, that the subtle things you remember now that you didn't remember back then, but I used to read movie magazines all the time, and I remember they were talking about Zodiac and how it was produced and how it was being made, but then it came out and I was like, oh, I read about that production, it's going to do really good, and then it bonged, and I was like, yeah, that's funny. But it's the chicken and the egg thing, right, Ed? Like, is it a problem that mediocre films naturally should end up on Netflix? Like, And Millie Bobby Brown, sorry, because I feel that's who we have to apologize to on this one who produced it. Like, it's not a mediocre film because it's bad.
No,
it's just
right, exactly.
It's not
one of the 50 greatest films ever made.
Yeah,
it's never
it just doesn't
get in that
cinema
list.
Style. Like, again, it's more of a series to me. Yeah. I'd be like, this would be if it was a TV show, I would have said it was one of the greater TV shows I'd seen this year. But because it's a movie, I'm like, it's an okay movie. It's like a movie I take my daughter to see. And I would catch it on an afternoon matinee or something like that.
Right.
But
it's like young Indiana Jones was on TV. It's cool.
Oh my
god. Still Indiana Jones.
Love that show.
Yeah, no, me too.
Love
but,
that.
You know, it wasn't the films. Like I think maybe that's the problem.
I had all those on VHS. Plus, did you know they made books? They had like young Indiana book. Oh, man, I had like the whole
that's
thing.
That's awesome.
I really love that show.
no, it was great. I remember it was the first time that I really realized like a story mechanic where you've got the old Indiana Jones, you know, at the beginning introducing the stories and stuff. And
yeah, see, these are the things, man. Like, it's funny you look back now, and some of this I do this in conversation with my family, but like, I always love the storyteller. Stuff like that. So the storyteller, I don't know if you remember that, Jim Henson's The Storyteller. That was
that didn't really come to the UK,
but
as far as I remember.
These were all shows, Ed, and I did watch a lot of TV, but my mom also watched a lot of TV, and these were all shows that when I was a kid, and I was a pretty nerdy kid, so I probably hung out with my mom far too late in life, but you know what I mean? Like, these are all shows that I would go and sit and watch with my mom, and we would talk about and like say how cool it was or which story we liked best. Like, she was telling me, she's like, you've always been this way. You just only noticed recently that you've always been this way. She's like, but we used to watch all the storytelling stuff when you were a kid and talk about it all the time. And there was just so much good TV for that back in the 80s, for like sitting with your parents and like watching something together and then talking about the story. Do you know what I mean? Like,
it was
a good time for that. So, but my fear now, Ed, is like, it's why I don't watch, you know, and this is no offense to all the syndicate TVs the general TV channels. Like, we'll catch them with my family, but as a person, I don't generally turn on, you know, Channel 4
NBC,
or BBC,
NBC,
any of those. And I haven't for a very, very long time. Like, that's not because I have anything against them. It's just I don't like commercials, and I just like, why don't I just pick what I want to watch? And so... In a streaming service, there's no commercials, there's no nothing. Like, you're just looking to see viewership numbers. And I'm like, is this just going to make mediocre films even more mediocre because they're just trying to get that spread of, like, viewership? You know what I mean? It's like, oh, I want everybody to watch this, so I'll make it as benign as possible so that, you know, it's just a fear. I don't think it really will happen that way, but, like, I noticed that with this. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think probably not. I really think that you know, the way that Netflix are doing things, I really like it. They are creating TV shows for all kinds of different people, you know. I mean, like, I wasn't the target audience for like Riverdale, for example.
Oh, great show.
You know, but like, it's out there, it's great, you know, it's well made. They're putting money and talent onto these projects, so I think it's really, really good. I think that here we have something that perhaps wasn't intended for Netflix, but actually would have probably worked best in Netflix in a slightly different format. But you know, the pandemic and the monkey wrench that this has thrown into the film industry, we're going to be living with for a while. I mean, you know, I work at a cinema, and like Disney are now getting really, really rough with their like demands on theaters. You know, and then releasing Mulan straight to Disney Plus as well. Like, unfortunately, a lot of cinemas are going to die because of this.
Yeah, and this is the thing, like, and it's funny because I sound very doom and gloom when I go through all these things, do all my critical analysis, but when I first looked at, you know, Enola Holmes and looked at what we were going to do for this episode, listen, the other thing I will say, and maybe this is because I deal in financial markets as well, like, people have got to stop panicking. Like, I don't know what's going to happen to big cinema. I agree with you, Ed, that for the time being, and at least in the short term, you're going to have the retraction of cinemas because people generally don't want to go. Like, again, it's, you know, the basics of this is supply and demand, and demand is at an all-time low. They just don't have people going to cinemas like they were before. So can't keep them open, right? No. That being said, does that mean cinema's gone forever? Like, No. Like, absolutely not. Once people are able to go to the cinema again, I think the funny thing will be, if you watch trends, people will probably go back more than they used to in appreciation
for
the fact.
Whoever survives, whether it's AMC or, you know, Cineworld or Odeon or what have you, they're going to be in a really strong position.
Yeah. And so that's what I mean. Like, the idea is, how do you survive? I think that's the name of the game, Ed. And that's the problem I have is, you know, if you spend enough time on Facebook or the news and stuff like that, it's all people talking about the end of days. Like, here you just have to get creative. Like, why not open to that cinema that shows Netflix shows or work out something with Netflix? Netflix has been buying cinemas, if I understand correctly, to do that. Now, the benefit you'll have, Netflix buys out all the cinemas in the world, guys. You'll have the same problem the Hollywood studios had back in, what was it, the 50s when they broke up the antitrust contract. So, you know, again, people freak out about these things and it's like, no, it always works itself out. And I think right now this is giving an option to studios, which are the ones you really need to keep open. The independent studios like ourselves, like, unfortunately, we can go underground for a couple of years and come back, but you lose a Fox, it's gone. You know what I mean? They're not coming back. RKO, there is no RKO anymore. You know what I mean? They're gone. Right,
exactly. United Artists.
Like, exactly. Yeah. Like, it's just because of the way they're set up and you know, the Wall Street guys that got behind making them. You know what I mean? So that's all I'm saying is, if this lets us keep at least two of the three, what do we have, three studios left? You know what I mean? Like, better for it. You know what I mean? Because we need more. And I don't think you're going to get more now into the other side of this. I think on the back end of all of this, when people start going back to the cinema, then we'll have a real time for growth, which could be good for us, Eddie. That could be, you know, never know.
Well, exactly. Like, if we're coming up at the right time, you know.
Love Victoria as a major studio. Who would ever thought it, right? So, but that's what I mean, man. Like, just be positive. It's the same thing they tell us as filmmakers. A filmmaker is one of the top things that I was always told by everyone else, and I wholeheartedly agree with this, because otherwise you'll just depress yourself. You have to just focus on what you're doing. You cannot obsess about what other filmmakers are doing, like, because everyone does. I say it because I'll go on Facebook tonight and see what like five of my friends are doing. Like, oh, I should have done that. But you really can't, because everybody's journey is going to be different for this. And everybody, like every studio, has to play this game the way it works for COVID. Like, if you need your stuff to be sold, you're going to have to sell it. You know what I mean? So you can keep the doors open a little bit longer. Equally, some of the smaller studios, the independent studios, are going to have to shut doors for a year or two, you know, because there's no way you're going to get a production out that's going to make any money in the cinemas right now. So that means if you've got a project that's, unfortunately, like we're talking about, our $8 million to $10 million budget, I think a lot of those are just going to have to go away, because who's going to go see them?
Or go on ice, like you say. Just, you know, pause, essentially.
Yeah. What I think filmmakers need to be doing now, and this is as much a message to myself as it is to everyone else, like, start looking at, you know, Ed sends me something about Netflix, I want to say once or twice a week, because we still haven't submitted much to them. And that's not because we don't like you, Netflix, it's because I haven't put content together for it. But that is where the money is right now. They need content to stay relevant. And I mean, that is a big concern. So once competition starts heating up from the other players, you know, what really is going to survive? Is Netflix always going to be relevant? You know, you look at what is different about the streaming service with Disney. What is different about the streaming service from Amazon Prime? What about all these other miniature streaming services? What about BritBox? You know, you're going to have a lot of competition out there, and I don't think it's going to be a one-size-fits-all for people. At the moment, Netflix tends to be that way, but I think it's going to, you know, evolve over time, and it'll just be interesting to see whether Netflix can evolve with that and keep, you know, moving on the program. Clearly, Enola Holmes was an evolution. Like, that was them seeing, well, given the circumstances of where the theater and the cinema is right now, this is how we have to release this, and this will be a good result, which ultimately it has been. They are, is it number one, number two on the charts. But
and I guess that's the good thing, right, for them, is they have that flexibility. You know, they can, you know, they're going to be able to weather the storm, like you say, because they're kind of the perfect setup for the COVID situation.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, in the current situation, here's, you know, on a money situation, so bringing you into the discussions happening above the line, the producer's office, listen, it's $150 million. The film's been paid for. It's done. You know what I mean? Or 70, 80 million, sorry, that was used to make the film. Like, and looking at, you know, this was back, I guess it was in April 2020 that they decided to sell over, because look at April 2020. You're about to try to get Millie Bobby Brown on a massive campaign around the world to raise interest on a really good new franchise. Like, I do think it is a good new franchise. But you're going to need a lot of footwork for that. You know, you have to be going everywhere, talking to kids, talking to parents, talking about how great it is for women's liberation and things like that. It's part of the reason I say it like that, because you're almost selling it that way. But that is the gig. Like, that's what's going to have to happen. And all of a sudden, you're being told no one can travel. No one can go anywhere. No one's going to the cinema. Cinemas are going to be closed. And Netflix comes to you and says, well, we could do you a deal. Like, we can't give you, you know, we can't give you the 200, 300 million you were hoping to make over 3 years on this, but we'll give you 150 now. Right. And so you look at it, you say, well, I got to pay Millie Bobby Brown, you know, for the rest of what she's owed on this. I've got to pay
everyone else.
I've got to pay everybody else. Distributors will have to pay on this. You know what I mean? So, okay, yeah, I'll take my 150, you know, chunk out my cash from that. And then Bob's your uncle. And so that's what I mean. Like, it's something that Netflix is very lucky to be in the position to provide right now. Will it last forever? No, but I think more films need to start considering, you know, whether this is the way they want to go.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. So, yeah, just a brief take on that. As I said, I know we talked more about the business behind it than the actual film itself, and I apologize. It's not because the film was bad.
I think that's interesting.
But it was just because when I watched this, it was embodying, I think, a lot of films you're seeing on Netflix right now, which are, you know, big budget films. I guess that's the last point I would make, and I'm making a lot of freaking points here, though. But last point I would say is, the other thing that I would say would be prudent, if this is going to continue, then I would say that budgets need to be reduced. Why? Because if you're looking for that lump sum payout in the beginning, then you really need to drive back costs, you know, from what you're making. That way you can get more of a profit margin on there. So not only do I think that will naturally happen from the studios if they're forced to use this model longer, because they're just going to say, how do I drive down my op costs? You know, how do I make this a cheaper production so I can make more money when I sell it off to Netflix? I think it'll also prompt filmmakers to hopefully start thinking that way a bit more. Because I just, some of the opulence, again, in Enola Holmes, again, I like it, but it's opulence. It's like, why did you need to do that? So, I don't know. At any rate, we are now just past an hour, so that's all I've got to say. Ed, did you have any closing comments on Enola Holmes?
No, just, you know, Millie Bobby Brown, if you ever listen to this, you're awesome, and I really, really want to direct you at some point in my life. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I've had the pleasure this week of watching Tom Holland and Millie Bobby Brown. I would say, like, for me, like, two rising stars. They are destined to be. They put the enthusiasm and amount of just effort they clearly put into their acting. And not only their acting, but also their public persona is just, that's really cool. Like, that's awesome.
They are hella charming.
Hella charming and understand the business. So good for you guys. So. But without ado, we will pick up next week with another new flick. We haven't picked it yet, so I don't know what it will be. But thank you so much for listening. If you have any questions about kind of the Netflix model or Enola Holmes and how that fits into that, or anything in general that you want to discuss with us, please put them down in the comment section, and we will get back to you very shortly with everything. But thank you so much for your time, everybody, and bye-bye.
Peace out. Bye-bye. Thank you.